Okay, so first I want to thank Clint and Bridget and all the other organizers of the meeting. This is what proves to be, so far, up until this point anyway, a fantastic meeting. It's going to drop rapidly. But I think, the format and the location are really exciting. Now, this was my remit, as it were, the questions I'm supposed to answer in this talk. And every one of them contains the word carbon, I think. Well, except for the last one, but they're basically all carbon. So I'm just going to go through this real quickly. Yes, sort of, yes, yes. Okay, so lunch. No. Right, so, you know, are the treatments, obviously there are treatments that you can apply to carbon to make them better. And fortunately, Bob has actually done a fantastic job introducing a whole bunch of the different tricks and, you know, techniques and things that have been used successfully for lots of different papers. And you can go through the literature and find a trick that worked for a particular case in a particular situation. And there are certainly lots of these things available to you. But I think in the long run, what we really want is to not need any tricks, right? And I think that's a big part of the goal of, you know, the automation work that has been done here. And also it's a big part of our work and our plans is to make this, you know, really robust and reliable and to start with some science that understands what's going on and then use engineering to actually solve the problems. So, all right, well, bearing that in mind, I'll just draw a cartoon that is obviously wrong, but everybody knows what an EM grid here looks like. Is that true? Is there anyone here who has not done cryo-EM, actually plunged a grid and made a sample? Raise your hand. No, okay. I just wanted to get the gauge of the audience here for different meetings, but this is a very high-level audience, so I'm going to skip all of that. And what I am going to talk about is some old stuff. So why, one of the first questions there was why carbon or why substrates? Why grids? Where did all this come from? So Bob showed a paper from 1960. I'm going to show one from 1934, which is, as far as I know, the first EM grid. And it was used for biology. It happens to also be the first paper on imaging a biological specimen in an electron microscope. And it was called, at the time, a net. But you can see it's basically just copper wires that were woven together. And that's what the specimen was put on top of. And of course, you know, it needed to be conducting because you're blasting it with a beam of electrons. It needed to survive in the vacuum of the electron microscope. And it was really handy if it had a bunch of open areas so you could figure out where you were and how big things were. Very soon after, it started putting thin films on top of this. There was really only a few plastics available at the time. The main one that everybody used was called collodion, which is nitrocellulose. It's the same stuff that was used to back film, movie camera film. And it's highly flammable stuff. Lots of famous fires happened. In film repositories because of it. But anyway, they immediately started putting down specimen on top of these thin films of plastic to help make them span the holes because normally they would, you know, often small specimen would just go right through the holes. And then it also was found, so this also points to one other point. As soon as you put the beam on the plastic, oftentimes it charged up, changed chemically, and then snapped and broke into pieces. That's because it's not terribly stable in the electron beam. So fairly soon after, people came up with the idea of putting down a layer of amorphous carbon on top of the material. And this is the first paper I could find in the literature. It took a lot of digging in the university library to find it, actually. You can't just Google Scholar this stuff, but it was there. And they took a normal grid coated with a plastic layer, and then deposited this carbon on top of it by arc evaporation and found that it was more stable than it would have otherwise been. And we have been doing this ever since. People started to get creative about it to see if they could put small holes in it. Again, very early work. You can play tricks to put very small patterns of little bubbles on top of a surface, which then allows you to pattern the plastic layer. This is long before the advent of things like microlithography and Intel and all the rest of it. These tricks were available to people, and you learned how to do them in the lab. And after you practiced it for a while, you could get pretty good at it. There's even more interesting things in the literature if you dig deep enough. This paper from Michael Beer actually describes taking graphite, thinning it down as thin as possible by peeling the layers apart, depositing it on an EM grid, and it'll provide this beautiful, very thin and transparent surface for imaging materials on it. He was interested in imaging biological molecules, actually. He was trying to figure out if you could sequence DNA in an electron microscope. And had he actually understood what he had done, he would have actually figured out that in one of the papers he published, he had a picture of graphene, what we now, you know, have the Nobel Prize awarded for many, many years later. We even have graphene oxide, almost the same chemistry that's used nowadays to take graphite and separate it into thin layers by oxidation. It was, again, in a paper way back in 1968. This is a flake of that graphene oxide sitting on top of a hole in a carbon film. And these are little individual 800 angstrom latex particles sitting on top of it. So, you know, these ideas have been around a very long time, and they all very much predate cryo-EM and a lot of the stuff that we've been doing now. So people thought about this in terms of electron microscopy for a while. But what we really need to do now is get serious about understanding exactly the problems that we're up against, that Bob very elegantly described in the previous talk, and then systematically going through and solving them one by one, right? And that's, I think, what we're after. And really, nowadays, having cryo-EM, what we basically do is what Jacques Dubochet and his colleagues did in the first cryo-plunge experiments, and that's why we use these thin films of water. We plunge, freeze them in grids. He originally just used bare grids, but it was rapidly apparent that adding a thin layer of carbon made things easier in the same ways that were done previously in electron microscopy. So there wasn't a huge amount of innovation here. The innovation was the freezing of the water into this glass state, which was terribly important, as you know. So where are we now? So Bob gave a very good overview of this already, so I'm just going to go rapidly through it. But we went through and sort of systematically looked at this stuff for a review we wrote recently on grids, because nobody had really done that before. And I had to come up with some sort of a vocabulary to describe what's going on here, because you'll see that things are called all different things by all different people. You have grids, you have foils, you have meshes, you have substrates, you have, and even by us, we weren't very consistent about our terminology. So anyway, for the purposes of this talk, hopefully in the future, I'm going to try and call these things with the following names. So the grid is the big chunk of metal that's shaped like a grid. The foil is the thin thing that's on top of the grid. And the film is the even thinner thing that might be on top of that. So, and this is completely arbitrary, but I had to come up with something so that I would call it the same thing every time. So if I start talking about a foil, I'm talking about the support layer with all the holes in it or some other sophisticated geometry that's sitting on top of the larger support thing that actually gets attached to the specimen support rod somehow. And all of these things can be made out of lots of different materials. By far and away, the most common grid material is copper because it's cheap and it's conductive and people have been making it for years. Gold is also very common, actually fairly cheap. Relatively easy to make, and less harmful to many biological materials. Lots of other things are available, and people have tried all of them in various ways and forms for various reasons. The foil, again, by far and away the most common is amorphous carbon, but nowadays we've started to use gold, and I'm going to talk very briefly about that. But other materials have also been considered and tried over the years, all of which, again, for different reasons, but have had some results in various situations where these showed promise for different reasons. And then, as you know, Bob has very elegantly championed for the past few years, you know, getting these particles in the hole in the way we expect them to is a significant problem. And it's our problem, not the biochemist's problem. And so one thing you can do is add another surface there to try and do something about the fact that when you look inside the hole, there are no particles. And lots of things, and this is not a comprehensive list, there's many other things that have been done as well, but But here again, if you just look at the literature overall, the most common thing that people do is add a very thin layer of amorphous carbon. By very thin, I mean, say, somewhere between 10 or 15 angstroms and maybe 100 angstroms. And then more recently, people have started to use graphene, which was what we've been working on for quite a while, graphene oxide, and some other materials. And as Bob showed, these two-dimensional crystals of streptavidin as well. Right, so let's talk about the gold for very briefly. This is the design of the gold grid that we proposed a few years ago now and have been using all the time since. And the idea is very simple. The entire grid and the foil are made out of gold now instead of having, say, copper and carbon. And we did that for a fairly simple reason. Well, first, this is what it looks like if you look at it in an optical microscope. So it's patterned in the same way that a normal patterned foil is. Contains lots of regular arrays of holes. You can see the foil is laying over the top of the edge of the grid bar and is in intimate contact. So it's both mechanically and electrically in contact with the rest of the microscope. And we got rid of the carbon for the following reason, among others, but this is the main one. And that is that carbon moves when you irradiate it. So this is an experiment where we've taken a normal quantifoil grid, which is a carbon foil on top of a gold grid. So everything the same as I showed you previously, except now it's a carbon foil. We tilted it to 30 degrees. It's cooled down to, say, roughly 80 Kelvin at liquid nitrogen temperatures. And then you turn the beam on in the normal sort of irradiation conditions, which we would do. And you see large amounts of movement. And this movement is in the vertical direction. It's hundreds of angstroms for a given image. And it's in every one of the images you take if you're using these type of grids. We don't normally see this because most of the time we look in projection view, right? So we're looking perpendicular to this movement axis. But it's not perfectly perpendicular. It actually has a slight tilt angle to it. And that's why it shows up in your images as a slight amount of displacement in the horizontal direction. If we do the same experiment on a gold grid under the same radiation conditions, the same geometry, et cetera, you can see the difference is quite striking. And if you do this on lots of holes, on lots of grids, and quantify the statistics of the reduction in movement, you find that overall, for no specimen at all, just the grid itself, these all gold grids move by about a factor of 50 less in a typical image. And if you add a specimen, i.e. a thin layer of ice, then things get more complicated. The motion is reduced on all of the specimen supports. So this is 400 angstroms. This is 200 angstroms in the vertical direction. But the movement on the gold grids also is reduced, such that it's still about a factor of 50 reduction in the movement of the grid in a typical image. One other property I'm going to mention today is conductivity. So another significant problem with carbon is that, you know, we think of it as this conductive material, but it's not actually a conductor. It's a semiconductor. If you look at it on the periodic table, it's right by silicon. And its conductivity or resistivity is actually quite high relative to what we would think of as normal metals would be, right? And so these are just three different amorphous carbon films that I made in the normal evaporation way, using various tricks and techniques, et cetera. But these were supposed to be all exactly the same, and you can see they vary by almost an order of magnitude, even out of the same batch out of an evaporator. This is actually the carbon rod, so the rod that we put into the chamber. It also has actually not particularly good conductivity, and the conductivity decreases, or the resistivity increases, as you go down in temperature, which is indicative of it being a semiconductor. Whereas gold is several orders of magnitude more conductive, and it gets more conductive as you lower the temperature, which is what noble metals should do. So, you know, the conductivity of these materials is important to us because charging is important to us. And even before we understood a lot about the charging dynamics on these grids, we knew that this must be at least somewhat important, because you certainly don't want to make grids out of things that are insulating, because the charge builds up so badly on them. Right, so what else can you do with these? I'm just going to show one unpublished experiment here. These are individual gold nanoparticles of the type that, you know, tomographers know and love and use as fiducial particles. So these are individual crystals of gold. It's embedded in a layer of water, just like our normal cryo-EM specimen. And this image is taken just like any micrograph on a Polara, the Falcon 3, 20 electrons per angstrom squared. This is just the micrograph. We haven't done anything here. If you look carefully, you'll see some interesting things. First of all, this is a defocused image. You can see the Fresnel fringe at the edge. But more importantly, you can also see these little bright spots on each side. These are the Bragg beams that have been diffracted out of this crystal. The 111 reflection of gold is at 2.345 angstroms. And it gets delocalized as you go to further and further defocus. And so this little beam here is that diffracted electron beam coming out of the particle because you're moving away from the focal plane. And if you do a Fourier transform of that, you can actually see the lattice. And if I, just to show you another example, it's a different particle. And if you look carefully, just so I try and convince you, can you guys see that there? So that's just right in the raw image. You can see the individual 2.35 angstrom reflection. And I think this is quite interesting, not necessarily because this is going to tell us lots about protein structure determination, but because it's going to allow us to understand some more of the physics that's going on these specimens as we irradiate them. And it's really only possible to do experiments like this when the movement of the particles is low enough that you can start to tease out different effects, right? Because basically, up until now, when particles are moving all over the place, and you have charging happening, you have other dynamics, you have radiation damage, all of these things are happening all at the same time. So what you really want to do to understand what's going on is try and come up with experiments, or at least what I try and do is come up with experiments that tease out one of the individual phenomenon, and then study hard on that phenomenon and see if you can understand it and figure out what's going on. And once you do that, then maybe you can do something about it. But the hardest part of this is actually teasing out these competing effects, which are all happening at exactly the same time. Right. So anyway, we do this on gold grids because the particles move very little, and it allows us to start doing analysis like this of very high resolution information and images that we wouldn't otherwise get from regular protein imaging without having to take, you know, thousands of particles and go through the entire reconstruction process. Right. So this is just a handful of structures that I grabbed from the MDB. They've been published in the last year, all done on these grids. And I think, you know, these have all been done completely independent of us. So I think it's reasonable to say that, you know, there is, well, that they work, basically. All right, let's talk about services. Sorry. John.
So you probably know we love gold grids, we use them all the time, but in the spirit of asking provocative questions, we're starting to get lots of structures, we can do statistics. Can you see an improvement in resolution from gold over carbon when you look at all of the structures that are coming out right now?
An improvement in resolution of statistics, I haven't done the statistic. If you look at improvement in the amount of movement or improvement in the resolution of a particular structure, then you can sort of answer that question directly. But as for improvement in the resolution of all structures, that I can't really answer that, really.
I have another question
whether
here.
Whether this is distribution.
So I don't quite understand why the gold grade can help for the charging, because the charging is a local event on the ice, which is not much of the conductive. So how does the gold help?
Well, that is actually an hour-long talk, and I can't go into the details of that today. I do have a lot of experiments, and we've just submitted a couple papers about this. But basically, if the entire membrane charges up, right, then you're starting with a ground plane that's actually far isolated from the surface, and that little local amount of charging that builds up on the ice layer, which is extremely insulating, as you say, is going to be affected by the buildup of charge on the surrounding areas. So they're not independent phenomenon. right? So, but in the case of a gold grid, you have a ground plane right up to the edge of the ice. So now only the ice layer charges up. And this is, in fact, the empirical difference that we see when we look at measurements of the buildup of charge on the ice layer. Anyway, that's a bad answer to a very long question.
Another very important effect is the secondary electron shower you get from the gold. So you radiate always a little bit of the supporting film, and this discharges the ice. And it's very easy to see with the faceplate. If you shrink the beam so that it doesn't touch any, say, carbon or gold on the edge, you see very strong charging of the ice by the fact that it goes off plane. So it starts to, you know, focus the beam. As soon as the moment you touch the edge of the carbon or gold, the ice discharges suddenly. So it's a very drastic effect.
Yes. Rado is completely correct, and we did a whole bunch of experiments to show what the effects are here. And so this is very interesting, but wasn't on my remit of questions today. So I'm going to have to table the discussion for the moment, but feel free to ask me, and I can show you videos of this charging phenomenon, et cetera. Okay, so back to surfaces. Right, why do they matter? Well, you've already heard about this at least twice in four talks, so I'm going to say it again. These interfaces really do matter. The proteins bind to them, and we don't have good control over this. This is just a tomogram we did a long time ago of ribosomes sticking to the carbon layer. So if you look at this is sections through it, and what you see is that basically all the ribosomes are sitting on the carbon, and then there's a few up at the top where the contamination layer is. Alex is going to show much more impressive and more interesting and more thorough data about this later today, because he's studied this in depth. But the very simple way you can think about it is basically it's sort of like this auditorium. If this were the hole and we're sitting in the ice layer, all of the particles end up sitting in the seats, you know. And once in a while you get, you know, some renegade particle that lands on the ceiling. But they're all stuck in one position, and that's because there's some very strong driving force that's pushing all of the particles into a particular position. And not only that, it's pushing them into a particular orientation. So, and that's, you know, and if Fan were to jump very high and stick to the ceiling, he would be the outlier in there. Just picking on him because he's not watching. But anyway, you know, as was mentioned already, there's a time scale for which this phenomenon occurs. You can do simple theoretical calculations to see how often a diffusing particle would hit one of the two surfaces of the auditorium if it were moving around in a random way. And it turns out to be very fast. I think Bob said the number 1,000. We just did a rough calculation to tabulate this to sort of get a sense of the sort of speeds you'd have to get to start doing anything about it. And I'm very optimistic that hopefully things like Spotagon or other very fast instruments that can plunge things rapidly may actually get you down into the regime where you can start to do something about this interaction. But another thing you can do about it is just to try and change the surfaces. And that's what we've been working on. So, and it sort of started with this observation. So this is an experiment I did quite a few years ago now, but it was taking amorphous carbon taking ribosomes. So we had two different ribosome specimen from Venky's lab. Very nice, clean ribosomes, published lots of papers with these things. So I was doing different tests on different surfaces to see if I could understand what was going on here. And so these are plots of the orientation distribution of the exact same specimen under the exact same conditions on two different substrates. One of them was the sort of normal glow-discharged amorphous carbon that we use all the time, or what lots of ribosome people use as this thin support layer. And the other one was with hydrogen plasma-treated graphene. And you can see the distributions are very different, even though both of these, I mean, these are both carbon. You know, the atoms are all the same. The bonding structure is a bit different. But the surface chemistry is very different. And what that means is that the surface chemistry of this thin layer that we've prepared actually can have a very strong effect on the orientation distribution of the particle on that surface. And this is true even from one ribosome to another. So if you look at the orientation distribution of ADS ribosomes, different organism, slightly different surface molecules, it's completely different, right? And it's also different from the sort of so-called air-water interface here, right? And so I think of these as actually surface maps of your protein. Well, they certainly are surface interaction maps of your protein. And I stared long and hard at the, you know, the density maps to try and figure out, you know, was this some specific molecule that was binding here, there, or there? But it wasn't. There was nothing obvious about it. But these are very subtle effects, and it's not so surprising because, you know, proteins are basically three-dimensional surface machines. Their entire way they function is based on the exquisitely tuned surface interactions. So these are very subtle things that we have to interact with, and very subtle things we have to start to get our hands on in order to control this this problem. Right. What's a simple way to know if you've got something wrong? Well, this is what it looks like when things are pretty good. But one very simple thing to do, and this has been brought up previously in various places, but Vinoth and Richard put this in a recent review they wrote, and that is just think about the auditorium. This is, you know, if you have a test tube which has a particular concentration of molecules per unit volume, and you were to take a sample of that into, you know, a fixed volume and then looked at it in projection, you should know exactly how many molecules there should be in a particular volume, right? Statistically, this is a very simple number to calculate. You can do it on the back of an envelope in 3 seconds. And this is just a table of that based on molecular weights. And the thing you need to realize is that if you are not getting the same amount in the test tube as you are getting on the surface of the grid, you should start to worry, or at least start to pay attention that something might be going wrong here, right? And what it's really indicative, in my opinion anyway, is that now you've started to enter the regime where you have strong surface interactions. It could be either direction, actually, but you're in a regime, or the piece of water that you actually put onto the specimen has had you know, some strong surface interaction on it. And that means that you're not getting a good representation of what was in the test tube, what you did all this, you know, blood, sweat, and tears of biochemistry to produce. And then I did another thing recently, just I was thinking about this talk, and that is I tried to go through the recent high-resolution literature. I just scraped stuff out of the EMDB, a bunch of high-resolution structures, and then I went into the actual papers, and not very many of them actually gave you the concentrations they used on the grid. But these are the ones that did, or at least that I could figure out one way or another. And then I plotted it. And in fact, if this curve here is the theoretical number that was that previous table, right? And what you can see is that it actually follows pretty well, that if the concentration that you see in the micrograph matches the concentration that they reported to put onto the grid in solution, then actually they're, you know, those are the ones that ended up in high-resolution structures. So there is some correlative effect here. It's not causative by any means, but it is a clue that this is, you know, that this is important, and that these surface interactions are important. So I think I'm just reiterating a theme here, but you can see it even in, you know, the published literature if you look carefully enough. Right. So what surfaces can we use right now? Well, there, as I said, there are lots of them. This is the most common. I'll touch on it briefly. We're working a lot on graphene. As it turns out, graphene is not the hard part. We figured out how to modify it to make it usable. The hard part is actually making the grids. And so that's actually turned into a big engineering project, which we're working on now. But a shortcut to that is graphene oxide. Graphene oxide is just an oxidized form of graphite that you've sort of sonicated. You get lots of flakes. Then it comes in a little bottle. You can take it out and squirt it right on a grid, and if you do it carefully enough, as they showed, you can get a nice thin layer where you get some overlap. Sometimes you get big, you know, multi-layers. Sometimes you get small ones, etc. But you can get a pretty, or you can at least look around until you find a good region. And it's very, very easy to do. You just need a pipetter. There's nothing sophisticated about it. Unfortunately, as Bob mentioned, sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. And we now have an awful lot of examples from other groups around us that have tried graphene oxide and had a lot of trouble. There are various parts of that contribute to that, I think. One of them is just that it's actually a very reactive surface, and it has roughly a pH of about 2, so there's all kinds of things that can go on between it and the surface. But we're hoping that eventually we'll have graphene as a very reliable support to to use. How am I doing on time? Who's monitoring me? What's up? 5 minutes, okay. So I'm going to fly through a few of this. I'm just going to skip all the plasma treatment stuff. You guys know all this, various things you can use. And I'll show this. So one thing that I don't think anybody's talked about that much is, you know, we do a plasma treatment to a grid, and then we put it in the plunger, and we use it, right? And we assume that whatever came out of the treatment stage is true when we actually apply the protein specimen to the grid. As it turns out, the surface is continually changing. And we've tried to start measuring this recently by using surface energy measurements. So these are all different support surfaces. I haven't labeled any of them here, because this is very recent data, actually. And they change with time. So we can actually see how the contact angle, and therefore the surface energy, of a particular substrate, like amorphous carbon or graphene or whatever you want, changes as a function of time, and as importantly, as a function of storage condition. And so this is sort of an old phenomenon in the literature about aging grids. Well, as it turns out, this is a very bad phenomenon that happens all the time. And a lot of it is contamination, but all other aspects of it are actually modification of the chemistry on the surface, I think. And we started to tease a little bit of this out by setting up an instrument that can measure this. But as it turns out, a lot of these time constants are on the order of hours or something. So if you think you can put a grid in a box and then take it back out and get the same surface, it's not possible, as far as we can tell. There are a few specific storage conditions which we've come up with which will preserve particular surface chemistries over a long period of time, but it's not trivial. And so you really have to be aware of this. And in fact, this orange curve here, which is absolutely the worst, that's a standard plastic grid box that everybody uses. So it modifies the surface of the grid almost instantaneously, within minutes. So if you take a grid and put it in a box, you've completely changed its surface properties. So this is going to need some more work to tease out exactly what's going on, but I think we have some good clues, and we have a handle on some measurements here, which will help us sort it out. Right. Graphene, I've yammered on enough about graphene for now. This is what it looks like normally. If you just use, you know, pure as synthesized graphene, it's too hydrophobic to support a good thin layer of water, so you end up with this sort of aggregation and rivulets, little clumps of water held onto by the torn up bits of ribosome that are left. So you have to make it sufficiently hydrophilic, but not so strongly interacting with the protein that you can get good interaction. The way we came up with to do this is to use a low-energy hydrogen plasma. It's important that the plasma be low energy so that the ions don't actually break or disrupt this surface, and that they just add on hydrogen molecules by opening up this sp2 bond to an sp3 bond. And it works. You can measure the surface energies. You can see how many hydrogen atoms you add per unit area by looking at diffraction patterns. And you can see the difference between adding the proteins in solution normally versus on top of the surface versus higher plasma treatment. So you certainly are tuning the surface interaction in one way. And we hope that in the future you'll be able to do much more sophisticated surface modifications of graphene than just hydrogen. And there are a host of different chemistries that are possible. And we've been working on these recently. Okay, finally, since I'm completely out of time, I'm just going to very briefly talk about...
Take a few extra minutes. I can trim my talk.
Thank you. Thanks, Bridget. I'm going to very briefly talk about this problem. So, you know, we really want to understand the surfaces, but we have to know whether we've done something well and whether or not we've actually made an improvement. So this is how we got into this business of understanding orientation distributions. And so I had a very talented summer student who came to work with me, and I said, you know, can we write down a mathematical equation that says that this surface is better for this protein than this one, right? That was the question we were after, and the result was this notion of efficiency. So this is, you know, the problem. This is what it looks like if you have a big, very strong orientation preference. You're smeared along one axis, and so you've blurred out all of these components in that direction. And we wanted to be able to say, okay, you know, if you have three different conditions, which one of these is actually better? And so I'm going to race through this, but the very simple idea is that we want to isolate the orientation distribution as a component of the imaging process. So how is that alone affecting the resolution of the final density map that we're creating? And the way that you do that is to make a simple model of what's going on. So each image of a particle in a particular direction contributes what is approximately a plane in Fourier space. It's not actually a plane, but for purposes of this discussion, it's roughly a plane. And so you can go through and take an orientation distribution and turn it into a filling of Fourier space based on all of the different views. I'll skip the mathematics of it. It's pretty simple, actually. But what you end up with in the end is a point spread function that describes the orientation distribution alone. It doesn't have to do with the detector. It doesn't have to do with the noise and the images, all of this other stuff. We just have a fairly simple model of what's going on. And then all you're looking at is how does your sampling of the orientation space actually affect your imaging of the molecule. And it's a point spread function just like you would have in optics. So a perfect point spread function would take a delta function or a dot in your molecule, say a single atom, and turn it into a ball, right? And the ball radius is the resolution, right? That's a standard sort of point spread function. And what we often have because of this poor sampling of the orientation space is something that looks much worse. You have a blobby sort of thing. So you have a direction where you've resolved things very well. So this is where you've got lots of views along a preferred orientation. And then you have another direction where you've resolved things very poorly. And now that you have this sort of mathematical formalism of point spread functions, it's very easy to then think about all these sort of questions like, is one better than another? And so we just came up with a statistical description that captures how good your point spread function is. It's very simple. It just looks at the distribution of radii of the point spread function. So a sphere has all the same radius, so it has a very tight distribution, and that gives you a very high efficiency. If you have a very good direction and a very bad direction, then you have this smearing, which gives you a very poor efficiency. And then you can start evaluating things. Go from orientation distribution to a Fourier space map, which then gives you a point spread function, and then gives you just a single number, which tells you how well you're doing. We tested this out on real data. This is the beta-gal data set it's a different beta-gal data set, but this is also beta-gal that Yifan mentioned yesterday. And indeed, it is just about perfect. There's almost no preference at all, and you get a very nice point spread function and a very high efficiency, about one. This is Bridget and colleagues' 20S proteasome. It actually has a fairly strong orientation preference, but because it's a very symmetric molecule, this gets rotated around the symmetry operators, and you still end up with a quite high efficiency and a high resolution structure. Asymmetric things start to get harder and also tougher. Yep, sorry.
That it's a special case. You don't really need any other view. It's like a tomography, right? You fill out all this. So we actually tried that. We exclusively excluding all the other view. You only selected given. So anything that on the angle is like say bigger than 20 degree, we exclude them into the reconstruction.
Yeah.
That to remove all this other view. So that still give you a beautiful reconstruction because you don't need it.
Correct. That's exactly what this is saying here, Yifan. I agree with you completely. But
a smaller.
I mean, you need a small amount of angle in order to fill up Fourier space in that particular asymmetric patch. But that's it, right? So you don't need much at all.
What number you would give?
Getting? Sorry.
In that case, because
0.7.
Point 0.7 is that is not as good as 0.9, right?
That's correct. It's not as.
In my view, I think this is should be equally good. In other words, I think that this 0.7 is something misleading.
I don't think so.
Because you don't need to be, in other ways, that 0.7 should give you equally good reconstruction as 0.9. That's the problem. That's what I'm getting.
Well, mathematically, I don't think that's correct. But practically, if you're already up against the barriers of some other thing that's limiting you, like say conformational heterogeneity or some other thing that might limit your reconstruction, then this isn't your limiting factor. So then that's not a
That's very contradictory with our when we look at
the panel discussion this afternoon, so maybe that's a great discussion to
really out of time, yeah. So let's do the skip to the conclusion slide. How about that? Usual trick. Okay. Okay, I'm going to skip the rest of that business and say, let's have an optimistic view of where I think we should go. Okay, so those were my sort of crude answers. In my view, what we really need to solve some of these problems is very rigorous control over the surfaces. So you can have a pessimistic view that, you know, every time a protein comes into contact with an interface, with a surface, that it gets pulled apart and destroyed. And sometimes that's true, but I think most of the time, actually, it's not true if the surface is engineered properly. And that's actually how we purify proteins in the first place, right? There are decades of engineering that go into making a Q and an S and a hydrophobic and a hydrophilic, et cetera. And not only that, but the process of doing those purifications actually tells you a lot about the surfaces that these proteins and the buffer conditions and everything else that they're stable under. So what I hope is going to be the case soon is that we have the same level of control over the surfaces on our grid as we do in our purification systems. And then we will be able to create a grid, and in even a single grid, where you have lots of different surface conditions already on an individual grid, which then allows you to select the space that gives you both just the right amount of interaction with the surface as well as a varying surface interaction to cover your Fourier space. So with that, I'm going to stop. So in other words, hopefully all the micrographs will look like this instead of just the really, you know, perfect ones that we select to put into the publications. Right. I will stop there and thank a lot of people who have been involved in the work. The main ones, so this is my little group here, all two of us, three including me. This is Katerina, who did a lot of this work on understanding orientation distributions and also measuring surface properties. Matthew has been working very hard on integrating graphene and gold grids together, and that work is very near ready for prime time, so hopefully I'll be able to tell you about that soon. And then I have to thank Lori for working with me for a long time on the gold grid stuff and graphene and many other things, and Richard for lots of other mentorship over the years, and some very other interesting projects we have going on now. And then all of the people at the LMB, it's a great community to work in. It's a tremendously fun place to be. And we have, you know, huge amount of scientific freedom, which lets us try all kinds of crazy things like this. So, and with that, I'll stop there since I'm embarrassingly over time.
Okay, questions? So everybody who has a question, please write it down. We will discuss it this afternoon.
Sorry.
Maybe a minute or two while I say that.
1 minute, so there was one who had the first question.
No problem.
Hi, Chris. So I have a comment and a question. I guess our experience with side views, with perfectly preferred side views, is a little bit closer to what Yifan described as well, where if you have the side views, you can completely fill up reciprocal space with the exception that you'll get lines in the z direction. And my question with respect to surfaces, I'm wondering, what are your thoughts with respect to how these surfaces affect beam-induced movement? I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the flatness of the grid and whether or not the flatness of the grid actually has an effect. I guess I'm thinking back to some old experiments that were done with silicon nitride grids where empirically it was observed that there was very little beam-induced movement even though those grids were actually not very conductive. But they were very flat. I'm wondering what your thoughts are on this.
So I think flatness is important. So even if you have movement and if your grid is perfectly flat and it's, you know, orthogonal to the direction, it's probably going to have much less of an effect. But sorry, the previous one was, let me go back to the other comment. Rotating plane. So let's see. The simplest way to think about this is if you had a crystal that was in P1 symmetry and you rotated it by 180 degrees, you fill the whole thing up, right? I mean, I think this is the mathematical thing that you're trying to describe. So that is true, but it also, you know, what you're ultimately after is filling up Fourier space depending on your symmetry operator. So, you know, if you were to be able to take your molecule and tilt it around, well, so if you have only one view and you then take that view and turn it 90 degrees, you're going to spin it around 180 degrees around the symmetry axis now, right? Because of the orientation difference. So you're effectively doing the same thing as you would with a P1 crystal that you put in a beam. So I think that, but that's all mathematically captured in this notion of a point spread function. I don't think we're describing anything different than that. And as far as the beam-induced movement goes, that's an important question, but again, that's an entire other talk. But, you know, flatness does matter and play a role, but there are other things as well.